Welcome, everybody. This is Lecture 6 for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, the Free Market, where we're going through the middle section of my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. Just a reminder for those who may not have realized, Lecture 5, which is on just standard supply and demand charts and how to use them and what they mean, that I was not able to give you guys through the auspices of this standard framework because I was stuck in a runway for 2 hours when we were supposed to have the class. And so I uploaded it on YouTube. And so those are actually nicer videos for posterity. And so that's at my blog. Check the news forum for this class. For those who are taking this class in 2014, you'll see the link there as well. Okay, so just make sure you're aware that those things are up there for you. And what I'm going to do, for those of you taking this course for credit who are doing the quizzes, I'm just going to wait and blast out the quiz for week 5 and then for this lecture that we're going to do right now for week 6, roughly the same time, because I know you haven't had time to watch lecture 5 yet. Okay, so for tonight, we're going to talk about interest, credit, and debt. And this in the textbook is denoted as an advanced topic, and it doesn't mean that the material is all that difficult, but it's just some of the things get a little bit more technical. You're taking the course and you're like a homeschooling student, or your parent is there kind of overseeing this. It's fine if you want to go lighter on this material, because it's not so much that it's harder to grasp intellectually, but if you're younger and have never used a credit card or used a bank and you don't do those sort of things, it's a little bit too abstract. But in any event, it's important material, and so let's go ahead and get started. So first of all, what is interest? We talked a little bit about this 2 lectures ago, but let's come back and hit it again. And just to remind you, this is something where the Austrian economists have a fairly idiosyncratic approach, because in particular, the Austrians stress what's called time preference. And what does that mean? Time preference refers to the fact that present goods are preferred to future goods. Okay, our present goods are more valuable than future goods. Okay, so loosely speaking, if somebody says to you, hey, do you want an apple right now, or do you want a guaranteed claim to that same apple that won't be available for 3 years? Most people are going to say, give me the apple right now. And if they wouldn't say that, then most Austrians would argue it's not because that particular person has a preference for future goods over present goods, but rather there must be some other extenuating circumstance that other things aren't equal. And if somebody comes up to you right now and says, hey, do you want to go out to a fireworks show tonight or in the future on July 4th, then it would be understandable that you might say, well, I don't want to go tonight. I'd rather go see the fireworks on July 4th. Of course, for the Americans watching this through the auspices of the Mises Institute, you may not like such displays of nationalism, so maybe you wouldn't want to go on July 4th, but you get what I'm saying. Or switch it to a more typical example is to say, hey, would you want some ice cream right now when there's a blizzard outside, or do you want ice cream in June when it's the summer and it's warm, and it's conceivable in the middle of winter somebody could say, oh no, I don't want ice cream right now, I'd rather you give it to me in the summer. Okay, things like that. So obvious cases like that, if a person does elect to get the future version of the good, most Austrians would handle that sort of case by saying, look, that's not really an illustration of someone preferring a future satisfaction over a present satisfaction, because the situations are so different that actually that same physical good delivers different subjective enjoyments in the future setting under certain scenarios. And so, you know, remember, everything is subjective in terms of explaining things with modern economics. And so that's really what's going on. The person is actually choosing the same satisfaction in the future over the present, but rather they're different types of satisfaction. Eating an ice cream cone in the middle of a blizzard is one thing. Eating an ice cream cone in the middle of summer is something different. So that's the standard way that people like Walter Block and Murray Rothbard would handle cases like that, because they want to stress the general rule of time preference. So what's the relationship? Why am I talking about that? Well, because with interest, I think the right way to think about it is to see that it's about time. And I'm saying that partly to be cute, you know, like, oh, it's about time, when you're exasperated with somebody and they're taking a long time to come around to seeing something or to show up. But interest is about time. That's really something that what's his face? Eugen von Bumbaberg. I think it was actually his birthday yesterday. But he was the guy, I think I mentioned him in an earlier lecture to you guys. He was a giant in Austrian theory. He was after Menger, but before Mises. And his seminal contribution, well, he had a lot of contributions. He gave a devastating critique of the Marxist system. But probably what he's most famous for is his work on capital and interest theory. And Bumbaberg was the one who first formulated interest as being fundamentally about subjective time preference and not about the productivity of capital. All right, so I'm getting into a little bit of deep waters here. So again, if you're on the younger side and you're taking this as a purely introductory course, you know, you don't need to worry too much about that. Let me now bring it back to more basic stuff. So what do I mean when I say interest is about time? Well, one way, and this really helped me to think about what interest is, and maybe it will help you, is that, let me jump ahead for a second here. Let's use an exchange rate analogy. Okay, so I think a lot of people can understand that, look, if, let's say there's a company that's operating in several countries, and so the company may, maybe it buys, so it's headquartered in the United States, but maybe it has workers, it buys raw materials from Asia, so let's say it buys it from China, raw materials from China, and then ships to Mexico, and then pays Mexican workers to take those raw materials and assemble them into television sets, let's say. And then they put them on trucks and ship them in the United States, where they sell them to U.S. consumers. So there's at least three different currencies involved. You know, the Chinese yuan, the Mexican peso, and the U.S. dollar in those operations, right? Because they have to pay the Chinese shipper, the people in China who are giving them the raw material, they got to ultimately pay them in their own currency. And then they got to pay the Mexican workers in Mexican pesos. And then obviously their revenues are coming from U.S. consumers in the form of dollars, U.S. dollars. Okay, so in terms of the accounting of the firm, when the owners say to the accountants, how did we do this year? The accountants can't report everything in the respective currencies, because that would be meaningless. You know, they wouldn't know. They'd say, okay, we spent this much in Chinese yuan. We spent this much on wage payments to Mexican workers in terms of Mexican pesos, and then we earned whatever, 5 million U.S. dollars in revenue. And then the shareholders would say, okay, so did we earn a profit or did we suffer a loss? They wouldn't even know. And so how would the accountants answer that question? Well, obviously they would say, what's the exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and those two other currencies? There would have to be a way to take the transactions that were priced in the different currencies and convert them into a common denominator, if you will, so that they could convert everything into U.S. dollars. And thus they could say, okay, we paid the equivalent of whatever, $1.2 million to the Chinese firms that shipped us the raw materials, and then we paid the equivalent of $2.7 million to the Mexican workers for their labor to assemble the TVs. And then, so that's, what I say, 1.2 and 2.7? So that's 3.9, if I remember what number that I told you guys. And then we compare the $5 million in revenue to the 3.9 in direct expenses. And so we had a net income of 1.1 million U.S. dollars. Okay, so that's the way they would do it. So the exchange rate, where would you get that from? How would you know how many Chinese yuan exchange for one U.S. dollar? Well, there's what's called the foreign exchange market. And so there are traders, not trader with a T, but trader, people who trade with a D in the middle of it. There are traders who trade currencies against each other. So there's supply and demand for different currencies. And so if somebody who has dollars, U.S. dollars, wants to buy something from a Chinese merchant, and the Chinese merchant will only accept the Chinese currency, well, then the American has to take his dollars and buy Chinese yuan with them. And that's how it works. So they're supply and demand for dollars against the Chinese currency, they're for dollars against yen, for dollars against the euro, and then whatever the price is, that determines, you know, that's what we say the exchange rate is. So if one U.S. dollar trades for 1.2 euros, well, then that's the exchange rate. Just like if one U.S. dollar trades for two big bubblegum balls that you get in those things where you put quarters in, well, then each bubblegum ball is 50 cents. All right, if one U.S. dollar trades for two of them, so by the same token, if one U.S. dollar trades for 2 euros, well, then that's the dollar-euro exchange rate. And so that would mean that you would, you know, sort of double or cut in half. The things with a certain euro price, you would cut it in half to get the equivalent U.S. dollar price. Or the equivalent U.S. dollar price, you would double it if that's what the exchange rate happens to be. Okay, so I think it's fairly intuitive and everybody understands what function it is that the exchange rate serves. It's that there's different types of money spread out geographically over the earth. And if you want to be able to conduct business operations and perform accounting operations to calculate profit and loss statements and so on, you need to convert transactions that are in different currencies into the same currency, and the conversion rate that you use, it's not like a natural constant. It's not like saying, how do you convert degrees Celsius into degrees Fahrenheit? And that's just an immutable principle. You know, when I say Celsius to Fahrenheit, so what do? You multiply by 9/5 and add 32. All right, with currencies, that's not how it works. With currencies, the exchange rate itself changes. It itself is a fluid thing because of it's just a market price. All right, so if I've warmed you up with that, now go back to interest rates, and I want to say that one way of thinking about them is that the interest rate is an exchange rate for the same currency, but over time. All right, so you understand that, oh, what's the exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the yen? And that's how you convert yen in the same time period into the equivalent U.S. dollars. Well, if you say what's the interest rate. If you say right now in 2014, the 1 year interest rate is 5%. Well, then in a sense, that's saying there's a 5% discount on money that's not available until next year. And so one way of saying it is that 95.24 today is equivalent to $100 next year. All right. Let me just check my math. I think that's the number. Oops. I'm trying to do it. My calculator. 95.24 times 100. Yeah. Because if you do $95.24 and you multiply it by 1.05, it's roughly $100. I mean, there's like the third decimal place is off. Okay, so just as if I told you, oh, the exchange rate between the dollar and the yen is $1 to 79 yen, something like that. I looked up the exchange rate recently. Or no, that's the one. I can't remember what the yen is. But anyway, if I told you what the exchange is, the dollar or some other currency is, 1 to 79 or 1 to 79.2, then you could convert U.S. dollars into that currency with that exchange ratio. So the same way, if I tell you that the interest rate that we should use for a particular calculation is 5%, then that's kind of like saying $100 of 2015 money, U.S. dollars, is equivalent today to $95.24, okay, because there's a discount involved. And so just as if you're going to be thinking about somebody in the comments is telling me that yen equals Japan. Right, I know, but what I was saying, the 79, I couldn't I was blanking out as to whether that was the ballpark of the U.S. yen exchange rate or the U.S. yuan exchange rate. It's the yen, I think. So just as with the business operation, it's got things going on in multiple regions at the same time involving different currencies. You got to be able to convert it to a common denominator. By the same token, if there's a business operation that's going to take place over the course of years, you have to be able, and it's in the same area. So you might say, oh, but it's all dollars. If it's all happening within the United States, that they're buying raw materials today for $1 million, they're going to hire workers over the next 2 years, pay them a certain flow of wages in U.S. dollars, and then starting in year four, they're going to start selling the product to their customers in exchange for revenue in the form of U.S. dollars. So we don't need any exchange rate there, but there's something analogous going on. Yes, it's not that we're moving across geography. It's not that we're moving across space, but we're going through time. And that, in that dimension, and a dollar today is not the same thing. It's not worth the same as a dollar next year or a dollar in 2 years. And so if those expenditures and revenues are occurring in different time periods, even though they're in the same currency, they're not worth the same thing. And so the accountants today, when they're trying to make projections and figure out if it's a profitable venture, you can't treat revenue that's not going to come in for 3 years the same as that revenue today. So if you're spending $100 today on raw materials in order to give yourself $100 in revenue 3 years from now, then you're losing money. That's an unprofitable thing to do, because $100 available in 3 years is not the same as $100 today. Just like $100 US right now is not the same thing as 100 yen. Nobody would be so foolish to think those things were the same. And when you say, well, gee, what determines what the exchange rate is between present US dollars and future US dollars? Again, it's the market. Just as there's a foreign exchange market where people trade currencies against each other, where people go to the market with dollars and bid on yen and people go to the marketplace with euros and bid on Mexican pesos, and that establishes what the market clearing exchange rate is among all the different currencies. By the same token, there's markets in which people effectively bid present dollars against future dollars. And that establishes for this moment what's the exchange rate between present dollars and future dollars. Okay, so I don't know. I hope that helps. I mean, certainly you can just study the standard definition and know what the interest rate is. And, of course, a more standard way you would think about it is just to say, well, it shows you how much you earn on a loan. So let me just make sure I'm not losing you guys there, that if the interest rate's 5%, normally the way somebody would think about it is that if I borrow $100 today, in 1 year, I pay back $105 if there's a 5% interest rate. Okay, so that's the obvious standard way to talk about it, that the interest rate just shows you on a loan, you're not just paying back the principal, the base amount that you originally borrowed, but you also have to pay interest on top of that. And if the interest rate is quoted as a percentage, then you multiply that by the principal to figure out how much you add to it. So in this example, $5 would be the interest payment, but the interest rate is 5%. And the principal is $100. But what I'm trying to get you to see is interest is a more general phenomenon. It's a more fundamental concept than merely saying, oh, if you explicitly borrow money from somebody and then you're paying them back, how much cushion do you have to add to it? I mean, yes, that interest is that, but it's more general than that. Okay, so you can reckon with interest rates, even on things that don't explicitly involve a loan. So again, just the example I was using, if you're taking money now to buy raw materials and then to hire workers to turn it into a good that you're going to sell down the road, strictly speaking, you're not loaning money to anybody. But yet when you're trying to figure out, okay, that $1 million in revenue I'm going to get in 3 years, I think, how should I compare that to the dollars I'm spending today on the raw materials? You go and look in the marketplace at the interest rates that are established through supply and demand to get an idea of what that conversion rate should be. And the reason, so even though you're not loaning money, right, so you're still using interest rates in your calculations, even though you're not loaning money anywhere, and it all comes back to opportunity cost. If you want to understand why should you do that, because let's say you can spend $1 million on raw materials today in order to have workers and hire workers to make a good you sell next year for $1.03 million. So you earned 3%. But if the interest rate's 5%, you lost money, effectively. All right, you actually had a negative net income, or you had a negative economic profit. The accountants would say you had an income, but you would know that actually you suffered an implicit economic loss. All right, and even though you didn't loan money to anybody, so you might say, what do I care about that 5%? Well, because you could have loaned it. Instead of spending your $1 million on raw materials and hiring workers to make that product, you could have just lent it out at 5%. And so you would have lent out the $1 million. A year later, you would have been paid back $1.05 million. Okay, so it all has to do with loans in that sense, but I'm saying it's a more general thing that it pervades all calculations, not just transactions that explicitly involve loans of money. Okay. let's talk about saving and growth. So in the, I think two lectures ago, we touched on this. It had to do with Prodigal Paul and Frugal Fred, that whole discussion. So again, just to recap that, we were saying that when households decide to save more, we know from the individual household's perspective what happens, that they earn more interest income over time, and eventually their total income has grown so much that even if they're saving a higher fraction, nonetheless, they can still consume more than the alternate universe where they didn't save as much and their income grew more slowly. And then we said, okay, but how does that happen at a macro level? What if every household does that? Can that be true of everybody and everybody's standard of living rises? And if so, how is that possible? What's actually happening in terms of the engineering? And we said, well, if a bunch of households start saving more, that means they're not consuming as much in terms of goods that give immediate satisfaction. And so the movie theaters shrink, you know, they lay off workers, they don't build as many movie theaters, the pizza places cut their hours and so on, right? And so what that does is frees up resources that otherwise would have gone into producing those present-oriented consumer goods, and now the economy can start cranking out capital goods, things like tractors and 18-wheelers, drill presses and so on, stuff that's that doesn't directly confer satisfaction, but is only useful in helping production down the road. And so that means workers in the future will now be more productive. A given hour of their labor will crank out more stuff because people in the past have saved and accumulated and invested. Okay, so now that we're armed with supply and demand graphs, so we know how to use those, I want to just show you the standard way you would depict something like that in one of these diagrams. So the one on the left, I've just put two of these diagrams from the textbook next to each other. So this one over here, you can see there's this, what's called the market for loanable funds. So this, again, this is a very standard framework when you want to talk about interest rates. And so you have the supply of loanable funds. So these are the savers. They're the ones who are supplying loanable funds. And then the demanders are the borrowers. Okay, so just make sure that makes sense to you, that we're talking about loanable funds. So funds meaning money. Loanable meaning money that's available to be lent and borrowed. Okay, the supply side, the people who are supplying the loanable funds, is the people who are saving. And then the demand side, who is demanding the loanable funds, it's the people who are borrowing money. Okay. And now, what's the price? Well, for convenience on something like this, we usually express the price as a percentage, meaning the interest rate. And again, that's just for convenience, and that's just because it's a standard way to do it. Strictly speaking, you could do it as a dollar amount, right? You know, because normally the price would be quoted in terms of money. Like if you were doing supply and demand curves for television sets, you would have the y-axis would clearly be in dollars or euros or whatever. And so you'd say, oh, if the TV set goes from $100 up to $150, let's look at the quantity supplied and demand. So with the loanable funds, we don't do that because we want to show I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. Because people are borrowing different amounts of money. And I suppose you could just say, well, how many total dollars are being borrowed, and that would be one way of doing it. But for whatever reason, historically, just the way things are quoted, you do it as a percentage. And so instead of saying somebody wants to borrow $1,000 and at a at a an interest of $80, they, you know, so many people would borrow $1,000, and so many people wouldn't. And then if the interest charged on that $1,000 loan drops to $70, now more people want to borrow $1,000. You could do it like that, but it's kind of cumbersome, especially because people don't necessarily want to borrow it in chunks of $1,000. And so instead of doing it that way, you just do it as a percentage. So you just talk about the loan being at 8% or the loan being at 7%. Okay, so that's, I'm just trying to explain to you why it is there's percentages on the y-axis, even though normally the price axis would be quoted in terms of money. And it's just because when we're talking about loans and interest, usually we just, because the interest is in the form of money and the underlying loan is also denominated in money, it just makes sense to divide the two and express it as a percentage. Okay, so if you understand that, though, if you're okay with that, then the rest of this is pretty straightforward. So we're still focusing here on the left graph. And so I just want to make sure you understand why these supply and demand curves make sense. Why is it that the supply curve for loanable funds would be upward sloping in terms of percentages of the interest rate? Well, because the higher the interest rate, right, as we move up this y-axis, that means when you lend money to people, they're paying you back not just the principal, but that much more interest. And so it should make sense to you that other things equal, the higher the interest rate, the larger the quantity of funds that people want to save. All right, so for whatever reason people want to save, it's like saying as the return to saving gets better, gets more attractive, that makes people want to save more, or some people might save who otherwise wouldn't have saved at all. So just, it's very similar to saying, as the price of gasoline goes up, the quantity supplied of gasoline goes up. More people want to sell gallons of gasoline, and existing people want to sell more units of it as the price per gallon gets higher and higher. And so that's what an upward sloping supply curve for gasoline looks like. It's a similar thing with loanable funds. At any given interest rate, there are a certain amount of people in the community who want to save, who want to lend money at that rate. And there's a certain amount they want to lend. And then as the rate gets higher, some people want to lend more. Or some people want to lend who before didn't want to lend at all. Okay, so it's the same idea. Okay, and then as far as demand, it's the opposite. The higher the interest rate, the more expensive it is to borrow money. And so you could see why other things equal, as the interest rate goes up, the quantity demanded of loanable funds would go down. Or vice versa, as the interest rate comes down, the quantity demanded would go up. And so that's why the demand curve is downward sloping. So in this original left-hand diagram, given our demand and supply curves, they intersect at this point. And I said that just happens to be 8%, and there's a certain Q star of total dollars, both saved and borrowed at that amount. And so the market clearing interest rate initially is 8%. Now, what happens if all of a sudden the community becomes more frugal? That for whatever reason, people in general in this community decide they want to start saving a higher fraction of their income. How would you depict that in a chart like this? Well, the normal way to do it would be to say the supply of savings increases. So the supply curve shifts to the right. And so notice we put a little 1 here, and then we draw an S2. And that has shifted to the right. And so if this was the original 8%, and Q, and then we'll put a 1 here for Q1. And then where the new intersection is now at 6%. So because the supply of savings increased, while the demand stayed the same. The interest rate dropped from 8% down to 6%, and the quantity of funds available that are simultaneously saved and borrowed increased. Let me make sure you're understanding this when I'm saying saved and borrowed. Think about oranges for a minute. Sellers are, if I tell you that, oh yeah, in this market, the seller sold 1 million oranges, and then I ask you, so how many oranges did the consumers buy? Well, the answer is 1 million. See that? If somebody is selling something, well, then there has to be a buyer who's buying, right? For every seller, for every successful sale, there's a seller and a buyer. So you could be a seller and be frustrated, but here we're talking about transactions that cleared. We're talking about if the market clearing price obtains and the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied. And that's what happens at the intersection point. That's what's special about the intersection point. Okay, so if you get that about oranges, that if I'm telling you, oh yeah, at the market clearing price of $2 a pound, orange growers sold 1 million oranges, well, then it also has to be the case that at $2 a pound, consumers bought 2 million oranges. Or 1 million oranges, sorry. I said the wrong number. Okay, because if somebody's selling an orange successfully, well, I mean, on the opposite side of that transaction, there must have been a person buying that orange. Okay, so it's the same thing with loanable funds. If there's a saver who's successfully saving $1 million and lending it, well, then there's got to be a borrower who's successfully borrowing that same amount of money. Okay, let me show you. I have here by hand. I just want to show you how you would draw this from scratch, this process. So you'd say, okay, first I'm going to draw my initial. So here's price and here's quantity. And here's the supply and here's the demand. And then you said it was 8%. And that's Q1. And then we said, oh, now the community wants to save more. How would you depict that? And you would say, oh, yeah, the supply curve of savings increased. So I'm going to put a little 2 there, and then I'm going to put a 1 there. And I'm going to draw an arrow to show that the supply curve shifted. And then at that new equilibrium, you do that, and let's say it's 6%. And that's Q2. You can draw another arrow to show which way these things went. Okay, so that's the way you would do it by hand if you were wanting to walk through the steps. And that's, again, this is just I'm partly showing you this stuff just so you guys know how to use these charts. And believe it or not, what I just drew right here, even though this came from the textbook, I literally used this exact thing 2 weeks ago. Well, when I was coming home from that talk in Arkansas, when I got stuck on the runway, I didn't have the 8 and the 6, but I used this thing because there was a guy, I was talking about Austrian business cycle theory and saying how when people save more in a genuine market and there's genuine savings, that pushes down interest rates. And then somebody in the crowd was saying, but wait a minute, when businesses borrow, they'll save, doesn't that push the interest rate back up? And so I was, I drew this kind of chart just to show the person, well, no, the supply curve has shifted outward. And that's why interest rates now settle down at 6%. And the person was also concerned that, oh, as the interest rate falls, doesn't that mean people are less likely to save or less willing to save? And so let's just talk for a moment about that. Because again, this is the whole, well, not the whole reason, but this is one of the main reasons that we do these supply and demand curves. It's not because they're realistic, of course not. There's no pretense here that straight line has anything to do with the real world in terms of the specific numerical amounts. But the point is just to help you think through something logically and not get mixed up, or not to walk around in a circle mentally. And so here, if you say, wait a minute, people are saving more and the interest rate drops from 8% down to 6%. And so then because it's a lower interest rate, wouldn't they want to save less? You can say, no, not if the reason interest rates fell was because they became more frugal. See, that's what it means to say that the supply curve shifted to the right. So make sure you get that the reason we moved the supply curve is because people's preferences changed. People wanted to start saving more. So what does that mean? It means that for any given interest rate, the quantity they want to save is higher than it was before. So it's still true to say that at 8%, people want to save more than they want to save at 6%. Okay, but there's no contradiction there because the supply curve itself shifted out. So I don't know if I'm going to make this, I'm helping or hurting here, but I'm going back to the previous slide because this one's cleaner. Look at this S2, this new supply curve. That is still upward sloping. So it's still true that if you look at this amount, this distance from the left side, that's how much they want to save at 6%. And if you moved up the curve to 8% this way over here, right? So if I extended it over the 8%, they want to save more. Okay, so it's this amount right here. I'm drawing the left and right horizontal gap to show you. Does everyone see what I'm doing there? That's just the distance from this point and that point in terms of the left and right horizontal distance. Okay? And that's because that's the 6% and 8%. If I just extended the line. I'm not drawing the lines across because I don't want this diagram to get even more cluttered. But I hope you guys see what I'm saying. That it's true as the interest rate drops from 8% down to 6%, that people, the quantity of savings goes down. That's true. But because the supply curve itself shifted, the total amount of savings is still higher now than it was in the original equilibrium. Okay, so this point here where we now ended up is still to the right of this original point, even though it's to the left of this point. Okay, so I guess if it helps you to think of it like that, you can mentally imagine that first society goes from this point to this point, and then it goes from that point down to this one. Okay, but notice that's still to the right of the original point. Okay, so let me just back up and make sure no one's getting lost here. In words, I said to this crowd in Little Rock, or it was in a town outside of Little Rock, I said, when the community becomes more frugal and wants to save more, they provide more savings to financial institutions, that increases the supply of loanable funds, and that pushes down interest rates. And so somebody in the crowd was worried about that explanation. He said, wait a minute. When the interest rate drops, though, doesn't that mean now the community's not going to want to save as much? So doesn't the story just turn right around? And so I'm trying to show you with these supply and demand curves how to think through all those things, and we can be assured that in the final resting point, the total quantity of savings is going to be higher than it was originally. Even though, yes, it is true at any given time, other things equal, the higher the interest rate, the more people want to save. And so the way to show that graphically with supply and demand curves is to say you have this original supply curve that's upward sloping, and then to say the community all of a sudden becomes more frugal means the supply curve itself shifts to the right. And that means, what does it mean for the supply curve to shift? Well, it just means at any hypothetical interest rate, the quantity of funds that the savers want to save and lend is higher. Make sure that makes sense to you, that's because in terms of the economy, there's no such thing as a supply curve. It's not just this graphical thing that's some real thing out there that physically moves to the right. What the heck is that? No, when we say the supply curve moves to the right, we just mean the plots that we're pointing are in a different spot now. So make sure you understand the underlying meaning of what these curves are even talking about. And so if the community now becomes more frugal and wants to save more, that means the supply curve, when we redraw the supply curve, it would be to the right. So it's not really that this curve moved, it's that we're redrawing the curve and it happens to be to the right. So conceptually, it's as if it shifted. Okay. So, and if the demand curve is the same, well, now the new market clearing price has to be lower. And so on the new supply curve, yeah, you end up at a lower point because the price has fallen, but you're still going to end up supplying a greater number of units than in the original equilibrium. Okay, I think I've hit that point enough. And the last thing on this is, remember, it's the interest rate that acts as a signal to businesses to know what the exchange rate is between present and future dollars. So remember before when we were talking about the accountants and they were saying, okay, we're going to spend some dollars today on materials and hiring workers, and then we're going to sell the product 3 years from now for a certain amount of revenue in dollars. And to tell if that's profitable or not, we need to know what's the discount rate on future dollars. And we'll look out in the marketplace and see. Well, now if households just start saving more, so the supply curve of saving shifts to the right and interest rates drop, well, now when the accountants look out in the world to see what's the exchange rate for present dollars against future dollars, oh, it's actually gotten closer to parity. That now there's not as heavy a discount on future dollars as there was before. And so a project that before was unprofitable, even though, so you spend $1 million today, and next year you bring in $1.03 million. When the interest rate's 5%, that's unprofitable. But now households save a lot more and interest rates drop down to 2%. Now that same project is profitable. You spend $1 million today to bring in $1.03 million next year. When interest rates are only 2%, that is now a profitable project. Right? Because if you just lent the money out, you'd end up with $1.02 million. But if you invest in this project, you get $1.03 million. But back when interest rates were 5%, it wouldn't be profitable. Why would you invest in this project and earn 3% when you could just lend your money out and earn 5%? Okay, so this stuff I'm talking about here, we're not going to cover it in detail in this course, but it's like the last chapter in Lessons for the Young Economist. So we're going to cover it in the next course, or if you want to read ahead, go ahead. But what I'm talking about right now is what's called Austrian business cycle theory. And so I'm just showing you the relevance of this stuff, that because the interest rate is a crucial signal that steers entrepreneurs when they're making long-term investment decisions, you can see how if the central bank injects a bunch of loanable funds into the picture and pushes down interest rates, that could mess things up. Okay, so in this diagram right here, up till now, we've been assuming that the reason the supply curve shifted to the right was that households became more frugal. They went from being prodigal Pauls to being frugal Freddies, and so they started saving more. But what if the reason the supply curve shifts to the right is because Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen comes on the scene and starts creating dollars and dump them in the credit market? Well, that would still make the supply curve shift to the right, but there's a sense in which something's screwy there, and that would still make interest rates go down. But now we have to be worried about there's a difference between saving that's coming from genuine abstention from consumption out of the household's existing income and savings that are coming from the central bankers just creating more money and dumping in the market. Okay, so I'm going to stop that train of thought because that's way beyond the scope of what we're supposed to be talking about tonight. But I'm just giving you a little hint so you can see why this stuff that might seem kind of obvious to you and simplistic, I'm just making sure you have these fundamentals down, because later on when you want to do Austrian business cycle theory to understand where does the business cycle come from, why do we have these booms followed by these busts, the story is developed by Ludwig von Mises and Hayek, says that it's because of artificial injections of savings that make the interest rate drop when it really shouldn't drop, and it gives the wrong signal to people. Okay, let's talk about credit transactions now. So they don't create money. All a credit transaction is that one person up front transfers money to another party, and then that party promises to pay back the money at a future date. Okay, so in the textbook, I tried to use an analogy to get you to see this. If I spend $100 on a television set, have I created money? No. I just traded my $100 to the seller of the television set, and he's transferred the television set to me. There's this, the total amount of money in the economy is the same before and after that transaction. It's just the owners of the money in the television set have swapped. Okay? Let's say I lend someone $100 and the person at 5% for 1 year. Okay? Does that change the quantity of money in and of itself? And the answer is no. And the way to walk through that is to say up front, I give the person $100. What does he give me? He gives me a piece of paper, a legally binding piece of paper that says, I promise to pay Bob Murphy $105 cash in February 2015, signed, you know, whoever the guy's name is. So looking at that transaction right there, that exchange, does that increase the total quantity of money? No. I had $100. I gave that person $100. He took out a piece of paper, wrote out his IOU, and gave it to me. So he's up $100. He can go buy stuff, but now I'm down $100. I can't use my $100 to go buy things anymore because I lent to that guy. Right? So the total amount of money in the economy has not changed. Fast forward a year later, well, he pays me back $105. Does that create new money? No. You might say, oh, no, but didn't it create $5? No. Not unless he has a printing press. He had to get the five extra dollars from somewhere. I don't know where he got it from, but he did. And so at that moment, what's happening? He's giving me $105, and I'm taking his IOU and ripping it up. End of story. So it's just a transfer. So just as, you know, let's say we weren't talking about credit transactions. Let's just say in the beginning, it's his birthday, and I give him a present of $100. I give him a $100 bill. There you go. Did that create money? Of course not. He's up $100, I'm down $100. Great. A year later, it's my birthday. Let's say that he and I are born on the same day. And this time around, he's like, you know, I forgot Bob's birthday last year. This time I'm going to. And he gives me $105 as a present. Did that create money? Of course not. He's down $105, I'm up $105. End of story. Okay, so I just showed you how in the beginning I gave him $100, and then a year later he gives me $105. And if I'm talking about birthday presents, you wouldn't think that it has anything to do with inflating the money supply. Okay, so now I'm saying instead of making it birthday presents, suppose the first year, the reason I gave him $100, not because it was his birthday and I would give him a gift, but because I was lending it to him. And in exchange, he gave me this IOU. And then a year passes, and now he gives me $105 in cash. not because it's my birthday, but because he wants to pay off that loan. And so then I take the IOU, I say, thank you very much, and we rip it up, and now the IOU is gone. All right, so there's no, that's not inflationary either. Okay. So I'm trying to just hammer home here, the credit transactions per se, there's nothing mysterious about them. It's just giving money, not in exchange for a tangible good or even a service, but in exchange for a promise to pay money back to the lender in the future. And typically there's going to be interest involved, so it's a greater amount of money. But that's what it, that's the nature of a credit transaction. And they don't per se create money. Even though the person, the obligate, you know, the borrower is typically going to pay back more, so what? Okay. Having said all that, you do have to be careful because in the real world, fractional reserve banking does connect lending, borrowing with money creation. All right, so I apologize if this gets kind of confusing, but there's no way around it. I on the one hand, I want to tell you something very straightforward and simplistic so you'll have it and you can walk away with it yours forever. And so that's why, I was doing the birthday gift stuff because I wanted to really drive home the fact that a credit transaction per se, the mere fact that I'm lending you money and that you're paying me back a greater number of money units next year, that's not inflationary. That does not create money. Just like with the birthday card example, there would be no reason for you to think, oh, well, gee, if he only gave me $100 for my birthday last year, and then I want to give him $105 for his birthday a year later, the only way that's mathematically possible is if I somehow get a printing press and create $5. No, it just means $5 that you would have spent somewhere else, you've got to cut back on in order to give this guy $105. You get what I'm saying? So in the same way, there's a lot of people out there that think the existence of positive interest rates proves we need to have a constantly expanding money supply or else the world blows up. And that, no, that's not true at all. Okay. But I can't just stop there because then you're going to walk out of this course, for those of you who don't know this stuff already, with the wrong impression. You're going to think that banking as it's conducted in the real world today has nothing to do with creating money, and unfortunately it does. So I'm going to come back to this in a few minutes when we talk about banking, but I just want to make sure you understand that it's a subtle situation. That's why here, just so you understand, I put this word necessarily in parentheses. So I'm saying credit transactions don't necessarily create money. They just transfer money from one person to another in exchange for a claim to future money. Okay, so I'm saying the essence of a credit transaction does not involve the creation of money. But unfortunately, the way our system works right now, there are certain types of credit transactions that do go hand in hand with money creation. Okay. But before we talk about that, let's talk about something simpler. What about bonds? What is a bond? So right now I'm walking through A, B, and C here are different types of credit transactions. So this whole section is credit transactions, and then we're going to walk through three specific examples that are common in the market economy. So bonds are simply IOUs that are issued by an organization. So they're fairly standardized. So it's a corporation could issue bonds. They'd be called corporate bonds. And so all that is when a corporation wants to borrow money from the public, instead of writing individualized contracts with each person, a bond is just a standardized, homogeneous, very marketable instrument. But all it really is, when you come down to it, is a promise by the corporation that it will pay the owner or the bearer of that corporate bond a flow of dollars. I'm just going to keep saying dollars. If you're obviously in a different country and you use different currency, just substitute your own currency. All right. So General Motors sells this piece of paper that's legally binding into the marketplace that says, whoever holds this piece of paper, we will give you $10 every year. And after 10 years, we will pay you back, or we will give you $1,000. Okay? Or maybe more realistically would be, we'll give you $50 every year for 10 years, and then we'll also give you $1,000 at the end of that. Okay? And so then how, when it initially auctions this off, why would GM do that? Why in the world would they issue these pieces of paper that are legally binding saying the person holding this thing is entitled to a flow of $50 payments from us for 10 years in a row? Every year we'll send them $50, and then at the end of the 10th year we'll give them $1,000 on top of it. And then they'll give us this piece of paper and we'll rip it up. Why in the world would GM do that? Well, because they're selling that thing up front. And they're going to sell it up front for $900 and change, depending on what the interest rate is. Okay, so that's the logic of it. If they sold it for exactly $1,000, then it would be like a 5% interest rate. Okay, does everyone see that? If they sold that piece of paper for $1,000 up front, then they're borrowing $1,000, and then every year they're paying $50 on it. So that's a 5% interest rate. And then when 10 years is up, they get $1,000 back. Okay? But what I'm saying is they auction those things off, and then the beauty of it is they're very liquid. If it's from a reputable company that people aren't worried about it failing. And so the person who originally bought this bond and gave $1,000 or whatever it is to GM, that person, if he decides he really needs money 3 years into it, he doesn't just have to sit there and collect the $50 payment for 7 more years before he can get the $1,000. He's free to sell that immediately to somebody else at a price that he and the other person negotiate. GM has nothing to do with it. Okay, so as interest rates move in the market, what happens is the market price of the existing bond changes to reflect it. And just so you know, interest rates and the market price of existing bonds move in opposite directions. Okay, so if you have, let's say originally GM's going to auction off this bond when interest rates are 5%. And what the bond does, so the bond is just a promise for flows of certain amounts of dollars. Okay, and when interest rates are 5%, and GM's going to issue this bond that's going to pay $50 a year, and then after 10 years it's going to return $1,000. If interest rates are 5%, then that bond has a market value of $1,000 up front. All right, and then, so you go ahead and do that. You give $1,000, you get that bond, and then you're earning the 5%. Now all of a sudden, people save a lot more and interest rates go down. So instead of being 5%, interest rates drop to 2.5%, what happens, your bond is now going to be worth $2,000, right? Because interest rates go down, so the market value of your bond is going to go up. And the rationale is because you're still getting paid $50 in cash every year. So if interest rates have dropped, now it's like saying your $50 annual payment, what does the principal have to be such that 2.5% is $50? So the bond has to be $2,000 now. That's the market value. On the other hand, what if interest rates go from 5% up to 10%? Well, now the value of your bond is going to drop from instead of being $1,000, it's going to drop down to $500. Okay, so anyway, that's I don't want to get bogged down on that too much, but just the important thing is you get the idea. These bonds are out there, and what they are claims on flows of money from the organization that issued them. And if after you're holding it, and so now you've got this bond that has a market value, you could sell it to somebody else for an exchange of money. And the amount that other person would be willing to pay you for it fluctuates depending on what happens to interest rates in the meantime. So after you pay the money out and you have this corporate bond, if interest rates go up compared to when you originally bought this thing, then the amount you could sell it for is going to drop. And vice versa, if interest rates fall, then you can sell this thing for more. So I have to move on now because we're running out of time, but just think through the logic of that. That should make sense to you, because just keep in mind that it's a fixed payment. The other thing, too, is I was being a little bit loosey-goosey there. The amount when I was saying how interest rates got cut in half or doubled, strictly speaking, that would have to be, you know, right at the moment of you doing it. It's because as you move along and you only have fewer and fewer $50 payments, that's gonna change things. Okay, because you're that $1,000 payment sitting there at the end too. Okay, so anyway, but I'm trying to just give you the general spirit of it. Okay, banks. The way to think about a bank is a credit intermediary. That's in terms of banks' functions as far as borrowing and lending. And so intermediary meaning it stands in between two parties. So you've got people on the one hand who are saving, people on the other hand who want to borrow. And one of those standard functions of a bank is to be a credit intermediary, that the savers don't go out in the community and figure out who a good credit risk is and lend money directly to those people. Instead, all the savers put their savings in a bank, and then the bank has expert personnel who interview people who are applying for loans. And then the bank determines which borrowers are going to get the loans or what the terms are going to be. And the interest rate that's charged partially is a reflection not just of general time preference, but it also is tailor-made to the specific borrower based on the risk of default. And so somebody who's a riskier, someone who's a bigger credit risk, who's more likely to not pay back the loan, that person will be charged a higher interest rate, because part of what that gross rate of interest is includes the risk premium. Okay, so before we were talking about time preference, that's one component of all credit transactions, the fact that if there's a delay of time involved, you got to factor that into account, that money today is not the same as money tomorrow. But beyond that, so that's true even if you're certain you're getting paid back. Right? If I lend somebody $100 and he's going to pay me back in 10 years, I'm going to want to be paid more than $100 probably, just because I don't want to have to wait 10 years before I can use my money. But on top of that issue is the fact that for all I know, I'm not going to get that money back. So you see how that's an extra component. That's why actually interest rate I'm going to charge in the real world is going to be even higher than just what it takes to account for time preference. There's also the actual risk involved. Okay, so typically what's going to happen is the banks will pay interest at one level to the people, the savers, and then the banks will turn around and lend that same money out at a higher rate of interest, and they'll earn a spread. So the people giving their money to the banks, the savers giving their money to the banks, might earn 3%, and then the banks turn around and lend that money out to other people at 5%. And so the bank implicitly is earning the 2% spread there. And part of that is, or the reason for that spread is partially it's because of the risk of default, that the bank knows that some of those loans at 5% aren't going to even return the full principal. And so they have to account for that. But it also just, you know, the bank has expenses. It has to hire loan officers. It has to hire experts who are good at evaluating credit risks and things like that. It has to pay for the physical structure of the bank, the rent, so on. So that's why it has to be that the bank lends money out at a higher rate than it pays to the people who give their money to the bank. Okay, now the problem is, let me just spend a few moments on this. There's another function too, and that's that the banks also perform a separate function. And I just listed a few ways of describing it. They could be a place for safekeeping your money. They can serve as a warehouse of your money and what we traditionally think of as checking accounts. All right, so in practice, the same physical building that we call a bank does both of these transactions. It acts as a credit intermediary and it acts as a place for you, just for convenience, for you to keep your funds. So notice, when the bank's a credit intermediary, in a sense, you should be giving up control of your money, and then the bank's going to lend it out to someone. That should be a credit transaction where you say to the bank, here's my money right now. I'm going to relinquish this, and then you're going to give me an IOU, and then you can lend that money out to somebody else. Whereas with the second type of function, you're just depositing your money with the bank. You're saying, hold on to this for me. It's more convenient rather than me walk around with money in my pocket where I could get, where I could, you know, I could be mugged or I could lose it, or it might just be really heavy if it's a ton of money. I'm going to just give it to you and you're going to keep it in your nice safe vault because it's safer. And it's more convenient for me to walk around town with a checkbook or a debit card rather than walking around with $10,000 actual currency on me. And so there, I'm not relinquishing ownership of my money. I'm just having them hold it in a nice, safe place for convenience. So a lot of Austrians, particularly those in the tradition of Murray Rothbard, think that those are two completely distinct functions and that they should be distinct. And that's what gives rise to what's called, if that distinction were fully maintained, we would have what's called 100% reserve banking, which is not fractional reserve banking. Okay, so there, if you have 100% reserve banking, what that means is if you think you have a checking account, you're depositing $100 in your checking account, and you're walking around writing checks on it and using your debit card to buy stuff, because you're like, no, I have $100 in the bank. Look at here, come over to the ATM, I'll put my card in and type up my account. See, it says I have $100 on deposit. So Rothbard and people in his tradition are going to say, if that's what the bank is telling you and you think that that's your money that you can spend, the bank had better literally have that in the vault, $100 fully backing up your checking account balance. And so that would be 100% reserve banking, because they have in reserve 100% of the funds needed to back up everybody's checking accounts. Now, in such an environment or such a system, banks still could be credit intermediaries. So it's still the case that if people want to save money and earn interest on it, they can do that, and then the banks lend money to people who want to go buy a house or something to give them mortgages and what have you, or somebody wants to buy a car, or somebody wants to start a new business and they want to get a loan to get things going. That's all fine, and that can still happen. It's just that money would be a genuine loan. So it's not that you would deposit such money into your checking account and then earn 3% interest on it, and the bank then takes that money and lends it to somebody else at 5%, because that would be fractional reserve banking. That would mean you think you have $100 in your checking account, but really you only have 20, because the bank took 80 of it and lent it out to other people at 5%. So unfortunately, that's what banks do right now in the real world. They engage in fractional reserve banking. You put money into what you think is your checking account, and you still walk around town thinking you can spend all of that money. And yet, most of it is not in the vault. It has been lent out to other people. And the bank is just hoping that on any given day, not that many people show up and try to pull out money from their account. Because if too many people did show up, that's what a bank run is. And the bankers would have to say, sorry, we actually don't have your money in the vault. It's, you think you've got $1,000 in your checking account. You really, it's not there. It's gone. Okay, so to repeat, Murray Rothbard and people in the Rothbardian tradition oppose fractional reserve banking. They insist on 100% reserve banking, meaning the technical term is a demand deposit, but just think of it as a checking account, saying those accounts would have to be backed up 100% by money in the vault. But So when a lot of people hear that, they say, well, so then I guess banks can't lend money out to anybody, right? If the bank has to keep everything in the vault, well, then how can they lend money to anybody? And no, because you're mixing up those two functions. You can't earn interest on a checking account under 100% reserve banking. How could the bank possibly pay you interest? If you go there with a $100 deposit and they take it and put it in a vault, they can't pay you interest on that. In fact, it's the other way around. They would have to charge you a fee because they got to build the vault and hire security guards and have cameras and stuff like that, have tellers and build ATMs all over the place for your convenience and have clearinghouse operations with merchants so that when you swipe your debit card electronically, it subtracts it from your checking account balance. All that stuff costs money. And so if the bank is not allowed to lend your deposit out to others to earn interest on it, clearly somehow you got to be paying for that. It could be a monthly fee. It might be an annual fee. It might be a percentage of your transactions. Who knows? But the point is you're getting all these services of convenience from the bank. You somehow would have to pay for that. They're not going to pay you for the privilege of giving you all those services. But what if you want to save and earn interest? Well, then that's a different type of transaction. Then you would say to the bank, here, let me buy a certificate of deposit or a CD. Or there might be a different type of account, a savings account, where you say, okay, here, I'll put $1,000 into this savings account where it's going to earn 3% interest. But I understand I can't touch this money for a year because I realize you're going to lend it out to somebody. And so I can't write checks on it. I can't log on online and transfer money from my savings to my checking account. The bank's computer would say, no, you're not allowed to. That money's gone. You lent us the money. We don't have it. Okay. So, I'm just trying to get you to see in the Austrian tradition, particularly Murray Rothbard's vision, he thinks banking should be 100% reserve banking. And the connection between this and inflation is that, remember a couple slides ago when I warned you guys, even though by its nature, per se, credit transactions are not inflationary, fractional reserve banking is inflationary. Just think about it. If I go and put $100 into what I think is my checking account, and then the bank takes 85 of that and lends it to somebody else, well, clearly that person thinks he's got $85 now. But I still think I have the 100, right? It's not that I now only act as if I have 15 in there. No, if I go to my ATM and put my card in and look at my balance, it'll still say $100 in my checking account. So I still think I have $100, but the bank took 85 of it and lent it to somebody else. So now that guy thinks he's got 85. So in a very meaningful, economically relevant sense, the bank, by lending that guy $85, created that money into existence. That if you add up all the cash balance of everyone in the community, the total just went up by $85. And that's because of fractional reserve banking. If you have 100% reserve banking, that doesn't happen. Because everybody's checking account is fully backed up, so putting money in your checking account doesn't do anything. The bank can't lend it to somebody else. And if the bank is lending money to somebody else, the people who lent the money to the bank know that it's not their money anymore. So if I go to the bank and give them $1,000 for a one-year CD that pays 3% interest, and then the bank lends that $1,000 out to a small business for at 5% interest, there's no inflation. Yeah, the small business is up $1,000, but I'm down $1,000. I don't think I have that money anymore. I have a CD from the bank, which is an asset, but it's not money. Okay, so with 100% reserve banking, banks could still be credit intermediaries. You could still have the expertise of the bank's personnel to channel savings into the right locations, into the hands of the proper borrower, according to, you know, market prices and so forth. But banking per se would not create new money. So I don't want to mislead you guys. There are some Austrian economists who don't have a problem with fractional reserve banking. Okay, but most of the people associated with the Mises Institute do, and for sure, Murray Rothbard had a problem with it, so that's why I'm stressing his view of things. But just so you're aware, there's a group of people called the Free Bankers, like George Selgin and Larry White are the two big names in that area, who think even a genuine free market, there would be fractional reserve banking. I think it would be optimal, as long as it played out under market conditions. Rothbard also thinks let the free market reign. It's just he predicts that in a voluntary market society, 100% reserve banking is what you would observe. Okay, let me see here. What else did I want to talk about? Since we're kind of running low on time, let me stop here and I'll answer your guys' questions. And then in the next lecture, I will possibly circle back with this. But, I mean, this stuff, I covered it in the textbook. I mean, there's nothing really too deep here. The stuff that I wanted to talk to you guys about in the lectures is what I was focusing on, the fractional reserve banking and Rothbard's views. The textbook, I mean, you can read that and see the pros and cons of debt and so on. So I probably don't even need to cover that next week. Okay, in the remaining time, let me field your guys' questions. There's a few here. Let's see. Malcolm Arnold says, could there ever be a currency exchange rate if there was no other commonly accepted medium of exchange such as gold? Well, Malcolm, I mean, correct me if I'm misunderstanding you, but it sounds like you're saying if there's only one type of money, would there be exchange rates? And the answer is no. If there's just one type of money, well then, there's no reason for one money to trade against another, and that's what an exchange rate is. But keep in mind that even in the market, even when people were using gold, people still use silver too. Okay, and so I how can I put it? My prediction would be that if governments around the world totally got out of the way and just let market forces play out, that you would, the gold would be the dominant money, but I think silver would also be money. And that people would use silver for smaller transactions and they would use gold for bigger ones. And that, depending on customs and local usage and stuff, certain prices might be quoted in terms of silver and other prices would be quoted in terms of gold, and there would be an exchange rate. And people would have to know the conversion ratio between gold and silver, and it wouldn't be a physical thing, obviously. It would be an economic thing. And so historically, especially in the United States, there were plenty of battles politically between gold and silver. And you might have heard of, like, they were called bimetallism, B-I, and then the word metallism, for like laws trying to make both of them the same. And Malcolm, following up here, is bringing up this issue of Gresham's Law, which is one of the first principles, like it's one of the first contributions to genuine economics in terms of economic science. Gresham's Law, people observe this pattern. And the standard way to summarize it, Gresham's Law, is to say bad money drives out good money. That's the standard quick way you summarize it. But what it means is, if the government comes in and enforces an artificial price control, then the undervalued money drives out the overvalued money drives out the undervalued money. And so so back when people were using gold and silver, like their gold and silver coins in people's pockets, and that's how they were paying merchants. And then if the government comes out and says, okay, we're enforcing this strict thing that whatever the gold price is, you have to do the silver price, and there's got to be a strict 16-to-1 ratio. So if a merchant is going to accept something in terms of gold at one price, if somebody else wants to pay 16 times the weight in silver, then the merchant legally has to accept that. Well, what would end up happening, and what did end up happening in a situation like that, is rather than fostering an environment in which everybody used gold and silver coins, which is what the intent of that legislation was, it made it just one or the other, depending on the vagaries of if gold happened to be worth more than 16. So if an ounce of gold happened to be worth more than 16 ounces of silver, then people would use the silver, and that's all they would pay with, and they would hoard the gold because the silver was being artificially inflated in value by the law. But then vice versa, if actually in the real world gold was only trading for 15.9 ounces of silver, then all of a sudden everybody would be paying in terms of with gold, and they would hoard the silver. Okay, so that's what Gresham's Law was. And I'm still kind of confused by your question, Malcolm. It's okay, so Joe has a good point here. I might be losing people. So Joe chimes in and says, Gresham's Law is why I removed pennies minted before 1982 and nickels from circulation. Right. And for people who don't know this, so in general, nickels and dimes and quarters from before, I think it's like 1962, something like that, have genuine silver content. Not much. But if you have a quarter from, 1950, there's actually silver in that thing. And so but the legal tender value of that thing is still a quarter. So if you want to, you can go buy coffee at Starbucks with a bunch of quarters from 1948, and Starbucks is legally obligated to treat each of those things as $0.25. But you would be stupid to do that because the silver content in those things is worth a lot more than 25 cents. Okay? So Gresham's Law in that context means nobody would spend the coins that actually have precious metal content. They would hoard those things, and the only stuff you would spend would be the worthless quarters, that the only reason they have exchange value is because the government has declared all that thing is by definition $0.25. Okay, let's see. So Malcolm says, I did answer his question with my fumbling about. Okay, let's see. One last question, and then we'll answer or we'll close it up for tonight. I have multiple chat boxes here. Okay. Ronald says, are there any 100% reserve banking institutions today? Didn't Murray Rothbard say that historically there were actually two kinds of banks, one for safekeeping and one for investors? This is a broad topic, and here I'm not going to exactly answer your question, Ronald, but I'll answer in the same vicinity of your question where I'm comfortable that what I'm saying is correct. So in the arguments, by the way, guys, in case you don't know, this is a humongous controversy within Austrian economics. This is probably the biggest controversy, not in terms of libertarianism, but in terms of Austrian economics, of this issue of fractional reserve banking. And the free bankers, the people who say, I'm okay with fractional reserve banking so long as it's generally done in the marketplace and it's not propped up by the central bank and the government, they will say, what are you talking about? Look at historically, fractional reserve banking is a product of the market. You don't see 100% reserve banking anywhere. So why are you guys thinking that in a free market you would see 100% reserve banking? So the Rothbardians come back to that point and they say, well, it's because the state always bails out the bankers or relieves them of their contractual obligations. So they admit that, yeah, historically, fractional reserve banking is ubiquitous, even as we go back in time. So even before the Fed in the U.S., there was fractional reserve banking. There always are banking panics and stuff like that, runs on banks, and that's why banks are always in trouble. That's why a bank run is possible, because of fractional reserve bank. That's why they're terrified. If all the customers show up to pull out their money, they're doomed because they lent out the customers' money. If you're doing 100% reserve banking, I mean, I guess you'd be mad if everyone showed up to pull their money out because then your business would be done. But you would be able to pay everybody. It's just that then we'd have no reason to continue in business. But with fractional reserve banking, when everyone shows up, not only are you out of business, but you're on the hook and you can't pay them what you owe them. Okay, so the Rothbardians concede that, yeah, historically, fractional reserve banking is the rule. But they say, well, of course that's going to happen because the government, think of it, if you're a banker, you like fractional reserve banking. People deposit money with you and then you get to loan some of it out at interest. So you're earning an interest income on the funds you lent out. But why wouldn't you do that? What would be the check against that? Well, in a marketplace, if you're not being backed up by anybody, by a central banker or the government in general, if you do that too much, if you keep too low of a reserve ratio, you might get caught with your pants down. And so in a healthy competitive banking environment, there would be a tendency for the reserve ratio to be higher than it is with the government. So now the government comes along, and now if there's a banking panic, the government might just say, oh, well, we're going to declare a bank holiday. And so everyone just go home. We're going to close the banks down, let the tempers settle. Everyone's got to calm down, stop freaking out. And then next Tuesday, we'll reopen the banks. Okay, so they just effectively relieved the bankers of their contractual obligations. And let alone if the Federal Reserve comes in and just creates a bunch of money and infuses it into the banks to provide liquidity or to be a lender of last resort, well, then, of course, you're going to be more reckless as a commercial bank because you earn income the more you inflate and the lower the reserve ratio. So the Rothbardian's point is, no kidding, historically, banks aren't practicing 100% reserve because they always get bailed out by the government or get relieved of their contractual obligations. We're saying if you took away those special privileges, then market forces would push banks, you know, if not to literally 100% reserve, very close. So that's the give and take. Okay, let me stop there because we're over time. I want to let you guys go. I will save these chat boxes because there's now some pending questions that I haven't touched, and I'll catch those at the end of the course when I go through and answer all the outstanding questions. Okay, remember, if you're taking the course for credit, keep your eyes open for quiz 5 and now quiz 6, which will be coming out back to back. All right, thanks, guys.